Well, amen. That was wonderful. I call your attention tonight to 2 Samuel 11. 2 Samuel 11. A couple of weeks ago, this is the chapter that I began, and I called it David's Dividing Line. Tonight, we continue with this same story, but the title of the message this evening is Uriah the Great. Uriah the Great. Now we are used to thinking about David the Great. Yeah, I mean, his whole life he has had victory after victory, success after success. David has always been a man that was large and in charge. He was always a man that seemed to have everything under control. It seems as though no matter what was happening, no matter what enemies were pursuing, he was always one or two steps ahead. And I think that the reason for that is that he had the hand of God guiding him. But sometimes people begin to read their own press clippings. They begin to read and listen to how wonderful they are. They began to think that they're as great as everybody tells them they are. And when you begin to think those types of things, you're headed for trouble. And last time we saw that David had not decided to go battle. They were to fight against the Ammonites. And instead of him going when the springtime came, they could not fight during the winter. They did not have modern armaments as we do. But they would have to wait until the weather was better. And so when Joab did not pursue in late fall or early winter, they waited until the spring, and then they went to battle, and they had laid siege to the Ammonite city. David was not there. David should have been there. Because the beginning of this chapter begins, it was the time when kings go forth to battle. But he was not there. He was walking around on the top of his house in his palace, and he's just overseeing the old city of Jerusalem. And down below is where his officers live. That's where the military barracks were. And on one of the roofs, he saw a woman that was very attractive, and her name was Bathsheba. And I don't know if it was a one-time thing or if it's something that he had observed for several nights in a row, but ultimately he asked around, who is she? They told him. And then finally one night the lust got so great that he said, why don't you go get her for me? She came, and when she did, they ended up basically sinning. And that's where we left the story last time. But I want you to look with me tonight at verse number 5 again, is the verse that we closed out with last week, or 2 weeks ago. And it says, and the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, I am with child. That's the setting. Now, I started out with saying that David was a man that was always in control. In other words, he always had a way out. And can I tell you that sometimes we are that way. Sometimes we get ourselves into a pickle, and all of a sudden it's like, well, if I do this, this will happen. And we'll begin to look at the dominoes in our mind and say, this will make this come to pass. The problem with that is not that planning is not good, because planning is very good. But I would not necessarily use the word plan in a positive context with our story tonight. I would think more of the word contrive, something that would have a negative connotation to it. In other words, he contrives up a plan, and he's trying to basically cover his sin. The great F.B. Meyer said this. He said that when we have sinned, we're more eager to cover it than to confess it before God. And I think that's true. How often do we act like Adam and Eve did when they sinned in the garden. They tried to cover themselves with fig leaves. And they were hiding themselves. And the Lord's walking in the cool of the day. Adam, where art thou? And he's hiding. And sometimes we want to conceal our sin instead of just confessing it and getting it under the blood. And so that's we find David in this passage tonight. So he always seems to have things under control, and he thinks that he's got things under control now. He thinks that the plan that he's got is foolproof. I mean, it's just, I mean, even a fool could pull this off. And so it kind of reminds me of another guy way back in the book of Judges, a man named Samson. What had Samson done? Well, every time the Philistines came against him, he defeated them. A lion comes against him, he rips the lion in his jaw and basically kills the lion. The carcass turns into a beehive. He puts gates of a city on his shoulders. I mean, he picks the post of the gate out of the ground and carries the gates of the city a couple of miles away, up a hill. And so he's feeling good. Nobody can beat him. And that overconfidence cost him. He lays his head in Delilah's lap, and finally, as she strokes him a little bit, he finally tells her what the secret of his strength is. She shaves his head, and then all of a sudden she says, the Philistines are upon you, and he jumps up as before, but the problem is he doesn't have the strength that he had before. That's what we see with David tonight. We see that David, until the beginning of this chapter, his plans were always good. His victories were successful. Even when he was hanging out with the unsaved people of the country of Philistia, when Saul was looking for him, and he went to the Philistine territory, feigned to be a madman, God even let them believe that he was a lunatic. And then he would leave and say, I'll go on a raiding party for you. But instead of raiding the Israelis and the people of Israel, he would go and he would kill other Philistines, bring back the treasure and say, here you go. God was always blessing him until this chapter. And so he's committed adultery. But can I tell you that when you sin, there's a knowing that takes place. When I say a knowing, I'm talking about there's a knowledge that takes place. First of all, the people involved know it. I remember when I had somebody say to me one time, you know, I just have a real hard time understanding the Bible. And I remembered a quote from Mark Twain, and Twain said this, it's not the parts of the Bible that I don't understand that bothers me. It's the parts that I do understand that bother me. And all I told the person was this. I said, you know, don't worry about what you don't understand if you're not living by what you do understand. And so you have David, and he knows better. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind he knows better. But yet, he doesn't want to lose face. And so, what does he do? He basically knows that he's done wrong. She knows that she's done wrong. She's violated her marital vows. She's besmirched the name that she had. Her father was in David's army. Her husband was in David's army. Her grandfather was David's advisor, Ahithophel. And so you've got Bathsheba knowing that it was wrong. But can I tell you, above all, God knew it. God knew it. And so you and I may remember our sin, and we may say, we'll just cover it. But the all-seeing eye of God sees it. And we need to realize that, and we need to really internalize that so that we're not fighting constantly trying to save face before a public. And so there's a knowing, and when you think about this, after the knowing of her conception, there came a showing. Now immediately, she did not puff out with pregnancy. Oh no. There are times when it's a couple of 3 months before anybody even knows that a lady's pregnant. Now, I'm telling you right now, you men, I'm just giving you fair warning. You got to be careful congratulating a lady when she's pregnant. The reason is because if she's not pregnant, there's no comeback. Well, congratulations, when are you due? I'm not due. What are you going to say? You look like it? There's no comeback. And so the best thing to do is just kind of play it cool and don't say anything until your wife tells you, hey, she's going to have a baby. Then you can get on board with it. But at the beginning, you don't know that. My wife knew that she was pregnant with our children a long time before I did. She maybe felt something in her body. Something was a little different. But during that knowing period, there's a growing period that begins to grow. And that turns into a showing. And so one of these days, David's knowing in his mind, he's thinking, if I'm going to get out of this, I got to get a plan. And that's where we see him. We see, first of all, in verse number 6, we see the liberty. You say, what do you mean by the liberty? Well, in military terms, if somebody is on liberty, that means that they are called home or they're on shore leave or something like that. They may have a weekend pass, so to speak. And so look with me at verse number 6. And David sent to Joab. Joab's the general. He's the one where the battle's going on. Send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. So the first thing that we see in verse number 6 is we see the liberty. We know in verse number 5 the reason why. It's because Bathsheba was pregnant. Now, David has never been one to give up easy. You can look all through his life and you can see that he's never given up easy. And in his mind, he's probably thinking, if I can just get Uriah to come home and go spend the night at his house, then everything will be okay. It'll be covered up. Because let's face it, in 1000 BC, there was not DNA test. All right? And so he calls him home and he says, I want you to have a little bit of liberty. But then verse number 7 shows us a lie. David is being deceptive. And he said, or it says, and when Uriah was come unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did. He didn't care how Joab did. He had messengers constantly coming to and fro, telling him how the battle was going. But he feigned an interest in what the battle was like. He wanted to know how Joab did. Joab's his nephew. Joab is the one that got up that water shaft first, and so therefore he's the leader of the army. He's the leader of the military. And so you've got the question, how's Joab? Oh, and then he really gets spiritual, and he says, and how the people did? How's my army doing? Abishai doing good? Everything good there? How's your daddy doing? You know, Ahithophel tells me a few things, but what's your perspective? And maybe after Uriah shares a few things with him, then what takes place, he says, and David said to Uriah, I want you to go down to thy house. Where's he at? He's at the palace. And he said, just take a walk down through the little small trails and passageways. And I want you to go down to your house. And so when he said that, I want you to go and I want you to wash your feet. What that means is that means that he wants him to go down. He wants him to refresh himself, possibly bathe, maybe just get a change of clothes, and just spend the night, you know, with his wife. And when you see that, it says that Uriah departed out of the king's house. But then I want you to notice how David is adding to it. He says, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. In other words, David is trying to turn this thing into a huge homecoming so that Uriah will just enjoy some food. Bathsheba may not have the good food that the king's got. And so he's sending all of this as part of a big package. So come on home. Tell me a little bit about the battle. You know, you've been such a good, loyal soldier. What I want you to do is I want you to just simply go home tonight and enjoy your wife. I mean, you've been out there battling now for a while. Back in the fall, you were battling. Just have a night off. I got some food that's going to go with you. And so we see that David is getting deeper and deeper. Verse number 9 through 13, we see a third thing. I want you to see the loyalty of Uriah. The Marine Corps have a motto. It's Semper Fidelis. And what that means is, it means always faithful or always loyal. We've got, I believe Brother Perry's been in the Marine Corps. All right? So when he would see somebody, he'd probably say, Semper Fi. We've had other people in the church that's been in the Marines. They would know exactly what Semper Fi is. Probably any of you military, no matter what branch you served in, you would have known what that Latin phrase meant. Uriah could have been a Marine, because he was always faithful. Now I want you to think about the character of this man. I want you to think about how he could have behaved differently. But can I tell you, I think that God just kind of put something in him that gave him more integrity than David. And so that's why I entitled the message tonight, Uriah the Great. We ought to be loyal people. We ought to always be faithful. And Uriah is a wonderful, wonderful example of that. Let's pick up in verse 9. But Uriah, now where did David tell him to go? Go down to thine house, and he's sending a mess of food with him. Wash your feet, all right? Refresh yourself. Enjoy your wife. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and went not down to his house. Can you not see God all in that? One of the things that I want us to do is I want us to always be able to look and say, I see God in this. I mean, I want us to look for the fingerprints of the Lord. I've had people say things like, well, I don't ever see God doing anything in my life, and all I'm thinking is, did you get up this morning? I mean, can you think logically this morning? I mean, God gives us breath. He lets our hearts beat. He lets us walk around on His creation. We ought to look at the circumstances that surround our lives, and we ought to see God everywhere. I mean, we ought to be looking and seeing Him all over the place. And so you've got Uriah, and he is sleeping at the door with the servants of the Lord, and he will not go down to his house. And so we see that he doesn't want to, but there's something inside that will not let him do what David tells him to do. Look with me at verse 10. And when they had told David, saying, Uriah went not down unto his house. In other words, David's got people watching him. Can I tell you that it's hard to keep sin a secret? Every one of these people in the king's palace, they're probably in on this. If you're working around the king, you're probably not stupid. All right? You probably can put two and two together. I mean, you remember a few weeks ago, all of a sudden late at night, you see a group of men walking through, and they got a woman that's following with them, and they go, got to be quiet. Well, who's the lady? It's Bathsheba. Oh, Uriah's wife. Be quiet. And all of a sudden, now Uriah's home. And then they say, hey, he didn't go home last night. And so, when they tell David this, they said this, David said unto Uriah, camest thou not from thy journey? Didn't it take you a while to get home from the battle? Why then didst thou not go down unto thine house? Why didn't you go down and take a bath and refresh yourself and enjoy your wife? I sent some food so that you could have a good night of R&R. But Uriah had something inside of him that was something that we should seek. We should seek honor. We ought to seek character more than easiness. We should not look for the beds of ease, so to speak, when right is at stake. And there are some things that people ought to have in their minds, and they say, I will not cross this line. And Uriah had a line like that. He loved the men that he served with. He loved his country. He loved the tabernacle. And when you see the question that David poses to him, Uriah answers him in verse 11. And Uriah said unto David, the ark. Now, what was the ark? The ark of the covenant. Where is that? The ark of the covenant, it normally resides in the tabernacle, but they would often take it with them into battle, because they wanted the presence of God with them in battle. And so no doubt they have taken this ark, they've put the poles in it, and they have carried it to the battle site where they have besieged the city of the Ammonites. And he says, the ark and Israel and Judah, the tribes of the north and the tribes of the south that have come together under your reign, Because you see, he was for 7.5 years only in Judah. But then when Saul died, Israel and Judah became one. And it was unified through the last 33 years of David and all 40 years of Solomon. And then it split. But you've got Uriah talking about the Ark of the Covenant, talking about Israel, the northern tribes, Judah, the southern tribes, and where are they at? They are abiding in tents. In other words, they're living rough. They're out there in tents surrounding this Ammonite city, making sure that no supplies get in, and basically they're starving these people out. That's what they're doing. And my Lord, Joab, in other words, the man that is over me, the general of my army, and the servants of my Lord are encamped in the open fields. In other words, you've got some of them that are sleeping in tents. You got some of them that are basically sleeping on blankets. And he said, shall I then go into my house to eat, to drink, and to lie with my wife? He said, as thou livest, and as thy soul liveth, I will not do this thing. In other words, if Joab cannot come home and enjoy his wife, I won't enjoy my wife. If Abishai cannot come home and have a good meal with his family, I won't go and I won't have a meal with my wife. I've got friends that are serving, and some of them are in tents, some of them are on the ground, and they're sleeping out there. The nights are still cold, and I cannot have this luxury while my friends and my fellow soldiers are not able to experience the same thing in their homes. But David, he's not one to give up. Can you not just see how that he keeps digging deeper and deeper and deeper? I mean, he wants to conceal it instead of confess it, as F.B. Meyer said. And so, look with me at verse 12. And David said to Uriah, tarry here today also, and tomorrow I will let thee depart. So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. So he's there with David for 2 days. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him. In other words, David is sitting there and he's got a nice, nice meal. Uriah is probably hungry. He didn't eat the mess of food that David had sent. He's eating basically what the servants are eating. They maybe have some type of porridge going on. Maybe they've got some type of bread that they have baked. But whatever it is, you can rest assured, it was probably some type of simple fare. And so you've got David, and he is there, and he's got this nice spread that's out before him. And you know what it's like when you go into a place to talk to people, and all of a sudden there's food everywhere. And especially if it's good looking food, you're going, that looks pretty good. That happened to me this morning. I was getting a cup of coffee down in the fellowship hall, and all of a sudden I'm looking over and there is nothing but just all kind of sugary things in Billy and Doug's class. And I'm thinking, man, I'd like one of them apple fritters. But I said no. And what did I do? I got out of there. Now some mornings, whenever I'm not watching my sugar, I'll eat one. But I went out, finished my black coffee, started talking to some more people, checking on Sunday school rooms, went down around the back hallway, checked in on a couple of the kids' classes, and then I stuck my head into the single focus class. And they got a Christmas party going on. And all I'm looking at is them pigs in a blanket. And I'm like, I got to get out of here. Uriah is watching the king eat the king's food. And what does David do? Hey, come on over. Sit down next to me. I appreciate what a faithful, faithful soldier you are. Now, all this time, she's with child. Her husband may know it, he may not know it. Somebody says, do you think he could have known it? I don't think Uriah was stupid either. Can you not tell when one of your family members has got something going on just by the look on their face? There are times when I can look at our church family and I can look at somebody and I'm saying, they got something going on. Your countenance betrays you. And here he is. I'm sure he's seen his wife. Possibly maybe she came to the palace to see him. I mean, you got to keep up appearances, don't you? And so you've got David and he's saying, come on here and eat with me. And what did David do? He makes him drunk. Can you imagine somebody that names the name of the Lord and what they're doing is they're trying to make another person drunk? Can I tell you that in the book of Habakkuk, it talks about a curse being on the man that gives his neighbor to drink? Why do people want to have other people drink? To manipulate them? Why do men want women to drink at a Christmas party? Because the women will lose their inhibitions and they'll be able to say things that you would not say if you were stone cold sober. There's always those people that are trying to intoxicate someone so that they can get an advantage. And here we have a man after God's own heart. Can I tell you that testimony is not applicable right here? And he says that he made him drunk. And at even, as he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of his Lord. But notice what the writer of Samuel says for the second time now. But went not down to his house. In other words, he might have been drunk as a coot. But he had not gotten so drunk that he was willing to stagger home, sleep with his wife. He wasn't that far gone. And so he stayed with the servants from my reading at least 3 nights in a row. 3 different opportunities he had to go home, and if he would have gone home, then David would have had cover. But there's no cover coming from Uriah the Great. Uriah is a great man. We'll get to it at some point in this study in Samuel. But at the end of David's life, there's some things that will be written about him. And one of the things that will be written about him will be a list of men and the accomplishments that these men accomplished as they were like David's, you know, special forces. Don't hold me to this until we get there. I'm doing this from memory. But I'm almost positive that in a list of David's mighty men, the last one that's listed is Uriah the Hittite, the husband of Bathsheba. God has the writer put his name in the Bible. He doesn't want us to forget Uriah. Uriah the Great. Now, David has tried everything he can think of. Hey, you're faithful. You've been good for my army. Go home to your wife. He doesn't do it. Hang around for a couple of days, thinking maybe he'll wander home. He doesn't do it. Hey, come on in. I've got some supper going on. Hey, have a drink with me. And he gets drunk, hoping he'll stagger home drunk, and he doesn't do it. But David, as I mentioned at the beginning of the message, David has always got a plan. The problem is, beginning in this chapter, the plans didn't have God in it. Up until chapter 11, you can see God saying, move here, go there, go here. And it's always a success. But David is now believing his own press clippings. In other words, he can do no wrong. Is that not why you have people that are in positions of power that try to manipulate others? They do things and then they say, well, I'll cover it up. I'll pay somebody off. And in David's situation, he goes even farther than that, and we'll see that next time. Let's stand together.